Welcome to the SportsX podcast. I'm Dr. Ashley Bassett.
And I'm Dr. Catherine Logan.
And on each episode, we chat about the most recent developments in sports medicine and dissect through all the noise so you know which literature should actually impact your practice.
On today's episode, we're focusing on Achilles tendon ruptures with Dr. Bonnie Chen. We have some great articles for you that contribute well to our conversation on the optimal management of Achilles tendon ruptures and the different surgical approaches. As always, links to all the papers that we discussed tonight is going to be on our podcast website, www.thesportsdocspod.com.
So we'll start off our discussion today with an article from the April 2012 issue of CORE, titled, MRI is Unnecessary for Diagnosing Acute Achilles Tendon Ruptures. Yes, it's an oldie, but we do think it sparks an interesting discussion about the utility of MRI in the setting of a clear Achilles tendon rupture. So this study retrospectively compared 66 patients with acute Achilles ruptures and pre-op MRIs with a control group of 66 patients without a pre-op MRI who were indicated for surgery based on clinical diagnostic criteria alone. So that criteria was 1, an abnormal Thompson test, 2, decreased resting tension, and 3, a palpable defect. And the authors found that these clinical findings were 100% sensitive for a complete Achilles rupture. It took patients an average of 5 days to obtain an MRI after injury and 12 days for surgical intervention. In comparison, patients in the control group were taken for surgery at an average of 5.6 days from injury. So no additional procedures were required in the control group compared to 19 patients in the MRI group. So the authors concluded that physical exam was more sensitive than MRI, and that MRI is time-consuming, it's expensive, and it can lead to treatment delays, which may be associated with an increased need for additional procedures at the time of surgery.
Then, from the April 2022 issue of New England Journal of Medicine, we review an article titled, Non-Operative or Surgical Treatment of Achilles Tendon Rupture. This multicenter randomized controlled trial compared non-operative treatment, open repair, and minimally invasive repair in 554 patients with an acute Achilles tendon rupture. The authors found that 12 months post-treatment, surgery was not associated with better outcomes than non-surgical treatment. However, 11 patients in the non-operative group sustained a re-rupture compared to 1 patient in the open repair group and 1 patient in the minimally invasive repair group.
So we're joined today by Dr. Bonnie Chen, a board-certified orthopedic surgeon and assistant professor at Columbia University who specializes in foot and ankle conditions. She received her medical degree from Stanford University and then completed her orthopedic residency at Harvard Medical School with Catherine and I. She then went on to complete a foot and ankle fellowship at Mercy Medical Center in Baltimore. Dr. Chen is passionate about global health and has traveled internationally to teach and perform foot and ankle surgeries. She's fluent in Chinese and English and speaks conversational Spanish. Dr. Chen has lectured extensively on the topic of Achilles, so we're really excited to hear all she has to share on this topic today. Welcome to the show, Dr. Chen. If you're looking for a trusted name in osteochondral allograft transplantation, look no further than JRF Ortho. With a stellar track record and a reputation as the leader in fresh osteochondral allografts, JRF Ortho is here to elevate your practice to new heights.
JRF Ortho has proudly distributed over 25,000 allografts worldwide, making a significant impact in the field. Their passion for this industry goes beyond the numbers. It's about helping patients and fulfilling their mission of improving people's quality of life.
But that's not all. At JRF Ortho, they understand that superior customer care is crucial. They aim to give you one less thing to think about so you can focus on what matters the most, your patients.
And they make ordering JRF Ortho easy. They're committed to accommodating your needs and delivering allografts on your terms.
You're in control. Choose your scheduling option, whether it's specifying a surgical date, providing a date range, or just requesting the earliest available allograft. Your preferences are their top priority.
So, prepare for success. Order with JRF Ortho and take control of your orthopedic journey.
Welcome to the show, Bonnie. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today and share your expertise with our listeners.
Thank you for having me. It's really an honor because you guys were like my big sisters and mentors. And this is like coming full circle.
You're doing great things.
Yeah. And especially on this topic, too. I feel like it was all over the news this past NFL season with Aaron Rodgers. So we're really excited to hear your thoughts as a foot and ankle surgeon. So part two is going to focus on all the surgical stuff. Part one, we'd really like to talk about your initial workup, kind of how you approach these patients, and then non-surgical treatment. So let's start with that initial evaluation. So a patient comes into your clinic with a suspected Achilles injury. What are you looking for history-wise? And then what are you looking for on exam to kind of figure out if there really is a true Achilles injury?
So the history, I think one is the timing of the injury is very important. Ideally, you catch these early on and direct them to the appropriate management, whether surgical or not. And the mechanism of injury, typically the most common sports, as we all can imagine, are basketball, tennis, volleyball, basketball more so for men, and tennis actually for women. And it's usually a mechanism where they're plantar flexing and then there's some sort of dorsiflexion force, like against their foot. And a lot of people describe like something hit them in the back of the heel, or they felt a pop, or like something went off, like gunfire or something in the back. And they think somebody hit them, but they look around and there's like nobody around. And so it's usually pretty clear when it happens. And they have difficulty walking, they lose their push-off strength, and they typically, once they realize something happened, will present. And on exam, I always still do like a full exam. I usually, if I have the suspicion they have an Achilles tendon rupture, then I set them up prone. And I make sure they have a good pulse. Just sometimes you just don't want to miss some of these things that may compromise their potential healing if they're going to undergo surgery. You can usually, if it's acute, feel a gap. If it's within the tendon, like it's a mid-substance type of rupture. And then if you do what conventionally many of us know as the Thompson test, you bend the knee up, and then one, you can compare the resting level of dorsiflexion of the ankle. And typically, if there is an Achilles tendon rupture, then there's increased dorsiflexion compared to the other side. And with the Thompson test, when you squeeze the calf, that chain of tendon continuity is not there anymore, and there's less plantar flexion with the calf squeeze. Sometimes it can still be a tiny bit because of the plantaris, but it's usually sufficient. You can see a discrepancy between the injured side and the non-injured side. And so that's the bread and butter, most clear exam presentation for these patients.
And then, you know, as far as like imaging, like, are you always getting x-rays and MRI? Are you, you know, we'll talk a little bit about that first Rothman paper, but, when you get x-rays, are you looking for anything in particular, or is it more just like a step on your way to MRI?
I usually always get x-rays. And the reason is on the lateral view, whether it's an ankle or a foot x-ray, what I'm looking for is whether they may have had something that potentially predisposed them to an Achilles tendon rupture, such as a posterior calcaneal spur. And sometimes these patients, in addition to having a tendon rupture mid-substance, can avulse the spur. And that's helpful to know, especially in the context of planning for surgery.
For sure.
You address the bone part in addition to the tendon. I don't usually get an MRI at all, especially if the exam is very clear and it's an acute injury, and it's a clinical diagnosis. And I think you can be very confident if all those things we described line up, the injury was recent, you don't need an MRI for it.
Yeah. And that, you know, the first paper that came out of Rothman, you know, talked about, do we really need that MRI? An MRI, you know, it's expensive. And I think it also, you know, it takes time. So it can create that delay. And you already alluded to a little bit about, you know, you want to get to these things as quick as possible. So that delay, and like when you're ordering an MRI and getting the authorization, it adds to things. Are there any sort of cases where you're like, ooh, I'm getting an MRI on this one?
Yeah, I think the cases where I consider getting an MRI are if I really am not close to 100% sure that the tendon is ruptured or where it is ruptured. Sometimes it's hard to palpate. One, because maybe it's partial, maybe it's a bit delayed in presentation. Maybe they had some chronic tendinopathy that just makes the exam a bit less straightforward, or just chronic. Then then I do get the MRI. And the purpose of that is, again, more for planning the surgery, like where is my incision going to be? And I measure it from the posterior calcaneus, like from the tuberosity, and I measure it to center the incision, and I don't have to make a bigger incision than necessary. So those are the instances where I would consider getting an MRI.
Okay.
So Catherine nicely brought up, not only is it a treatment delay, so you have to get them scheduled and things like that, but also costs as well too. And we have these rising healthcare costs. So there's been some papers looking at the utility of ultrasound. Do you use ultrasound, or does anyone in your clinic use ultrasound as like a quick test to kind of see where that location of the tear is in terms of surgical planning and maybe avoiding that MRI?
That's a great point. I don't personally use ultrasound. I'm not trained. I think there's always a user variance and dependence on the quality of the exam. I do have colleagues who can perform it routinely. So I think there is some role if it's accessible, if it's just for more of a quick diagnosis of, oh, is the tendon ruptured? Where is it ruptured? I think there's utility. If it's more that, okay, there, it's a more chronic injury and I want to see the degree of potential like tendon retraction and perhaps some tendinopathy that the patient may have had pre-existing that may influence my treatment options, particularly with surgery, then I think the MRI would still give a bit more detail.
Yeah.
But certainly I think there are benefits to when the ultrasound can be helpful for a quick, cost-effective, just more direct of a diagnosis.
Yeah, I think, ultrasound, it's such like, you know, it's just such not a big part of surgical training. You know, I think they get a lot more of it when they're, you know, if you're doing sort of the non-op sports medicine route. But I feel like it would be something nice for us to have like a rotation, you know, just to get a little bit more facile, like even if it's sort of like for deeper injections or, you know, some people will use it for rotator cuff to like look at the repair postoperatively, but it just, you know, it's a little tricky. I wish we had some more training on it. But okay. So, you know, say you've gone through that initial workup, and you have a confirmation that we have a complete tear mid substance of the Achilles. So, you know, what's next, like whether it's non-op or op. So that paper from the New England Journal of Medicine from April 2022, it looked at surgical repair and non-surgical for Achilles tendon ruptures. And so before we get into the conclusions, like, you know, Bonnie, how do you talk your patients through this process and determining like which treatment is best for them and like, what goes into your process for trying to say like this person's going to do better with non-op, you know, whether it's like age, activity level, job, all those types of things. What do you, you know, how do you work through that yourself, Bonnie?
So yeah, for the papers that I think a lot of the higher quality, more recent ones that have come out, based on that, and I think it's a very individualized discussion. I think in the foot and ankle community, at least, and probably same for sports, I think there's been an increase in the number of operative Achilles management and just like this uprise in like operative treatment that's offered. And so what I usually tell patients is you really can go one of two ways, like surgery or no surgery. Pros and cons. So non-surgery, the pros are you avoid surgery complications, particularly with wound healing, infection, dehiscence, possibly like more extensive scar tissue fibrosis formation, potential nerve injury, especially of the sural nerve. And so those are sort of the pros. The cons are that potentially with non-operative management, if you're extremely active and maybe you do some activity that requires a lot of plantar flexion strength or like high velocity with plantar flexion, like with push-off, you may feel a difference in that strength and that velocity and speed. With non-operative treatment, there may be a higher risk of re-rupture in the future. Although with some of the rehab, functional rehab, like more accelerated rehab protocols, I think that has equalized a bit more in terms of surgery and no surgery and with the re-rupture rate. And with surgery, I think it's kind of the flip side, like the pros and cons are kind of like flipped. So the pros are potentially you restore better plantar flexion strength and velocity, re-rupture rate may be lowered, but it does come with the risk of having surgery. And I think that can be a serious consideration. And in terms of functional outcomes, if we even take away like that high velocity and high strength push-off plantar flexion, a lot of the studies show that the functional outcomes are really pretty equivalent. Like your kind of day-to-day stuff you do and activities, daily life, sports. So I just lay it like that. And and you know, I've had patients go both ways, whether they're young or they're old. Like a 70-year-old mm-hmm. want surgery, and then I've had 30-year-olds who didn't want surgery. And I don't necessarily say like one's better. I think I want them to take that information and consider it for themselves. And I've certainly had like young patients who I would think, you know, you're healthy, you should heal this really well, and then they still might have a complication with the wound.
Right.
So
Bonnie, you had said that though there's a difference in re-rupture between the groups, looking at, especially this paper, found I think it was like 6% in the non-op group compared to 0.6% in the repair group, both open and percutaneous, but their outcomes are equivalent. How do you rectify that? Because like there's some data in the rotator cuff world where like they may have a higher rate of re-tearing the rotator cuff, but equivalent outcomes. And people say, well, it's because functionally they go to PT and they get their strength back. Like, how do you rectify a higher rate of re-rupture but equivalent functional outcomes when you're talking about this with your patients?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, having a re-rupture, sort of like going back to initially when they ruptured it, it can still be managed and treated, and then they can still kind of get back to doing what they need to do. And it's hard to know with a lot of these studies, like when they really collect the outcome measures relative to when the re-rupture may have happened. Is it like close to when it happened? Is it like later? And maybe like, what is the extent of the re-rupture? Like I think it's a little bit unknown, in terms of exactly like what the direct correlation between having a rupture and the functional outcomes of these patients may be. I think expectation setting probably is really important. Like they know that ideally that there's a chance this can re-rupture. They know it's a time intensive, extensive recovery, whether you have surgery or not. And so when they have a re-rupture, it's like, oh, well, I kind of know like I need to rehab this again. So I wonder if all of those things factor into it, that they kind of buy into it. This is like for the long haul, and okay, like I'm not going to expect myself to like get back right away, and that may influence like how they rate their functional outcomes. And a lot of these studies are not based on, you know, some of them are that we I think have as part of the discussion, but a lot of these patients aren't necessarily very, very high level elite athletes, and mm-hmm. and the demand of what they need to do is different.
Yeah, sense. We kind of, when we were talking about the workup and decision making, we did skip over job a little bit. What about like occupation? Obviously, you know, if they have like a high end sort of like ideals about where they return to sports, you know, that factors into, but what about someone who's doing like more manual labor or sort of heavy lifting? Like, how do you factor that in there?
I don't necessarily, I wouldn't say I personally have that sway me so much in the operative or non-operative pathway, because I don't think we know from the data whether or not like surgery or non-surgery really, really make your recovery faster to go back to work. I think that's not really clear. I think we know about like relative equivalence of functional outcomes and possibly the re-rupture rate is a little different. But in terms of the speed to like getting back to doing things, I say compared to like a Jones fracture, I think it's different. And I tell my patients too, like doing surgery is not necessarily, doesn't mean like we're rushing. Like it doesn't mean your actual rehab protocol is going to be accelerated. It's actually in some ways slowed down because I need your wound to heal first for like the first 2 to 3 weeks before we start cranking and getting to work with the physical therapy.
So, Bonnie, I think that segues really nicely into a discussion of what your non-surgical treatment entails. So what does your non-operative protocol look like? And I'm really excited to hear this because I feel like when I was putting mine together, there's a lot of different protocols out there in terms of like how long you keep them in a boot. Do you cast them? How long are they immobilized? Do you start weight bearing early? How early? Kind of all of that. Can you walk us through your protocol and how you approach these patients, like what you're telling them in clinic?
It depends a little bit of when they see me, like, is it right after it just happened or maybe 1 to 2 weeks like after the injury? Generally, I'm in favor, and I think there's evidence for like more of an accelerated functional rehabilitation protocol now where I don't cast them, I don't splint them and keep them in plantar flexion for like a month or something before starting them with therapy. I usually start with like toe touch basically right away, boot, like 3 wedges in the boot. And then I do restrict the amount of dorsiflexion. So both passive and active. Like I always tell them like, if anything is going to stretch out, like whether a surgery or no surgery is going to stretch out, what you want to do is keep the tendon ends as close together as possible and approximate an overlap. And you want that to scar in, and it takes weeks, like at least probably 6 weeks for that to happen. And it's going to feel tight, but we'd rather have that because you will regain the flexibility, but you won't really be able to regain the tension if it's stretched out. And there's a tendency for it to stretch out. So I do have them sort of stay out of any dorsiflexion. Like I kind of keep them like sort of 10 degrees plantar flex. So it's like kind of negative 10 degrees of dorsiflexion for almost like 6 weeks.
Okay.
And maybe like from the 4 to 6 weeks, I let them kind of actively dorsiflex to neutral, but no, nobody's like passively pushing them. And then from initially to about 6 weeks from the injury, then I wean the number of wedges, kind of like 2 week, one wedge, 2 weeks at a time. And then they're basically fully weight bearing at about 6 weeks. Then I wean them out of a boot at about 6 weeks from injury, and I switch them to a shoe maybe about 2 months after the injury. I personally still put like a heel lift in their shoe and kind of do the 3-2-1 heel lift.
Okay.
Again, just to keep that tension, still protect the tendon. I start the dorsiflexion at about 6 to 8 weeks.
Okay.
That they start more of the flexibility.
And Bonnie, how is their boot?
Yeah.
Like, do you do the boot all the way up to the knee always?
I usually do. Yeah, just because sometimes I find, and depending on the size of the patient, sometimes when you like put the heel lifts up, then it kind of moves out the boot if it's too short. Yeah.
What about at night? Do you let them do, I've seen those, like I've had patients ask about those night splints to sleep in those where they like sleep in a little bit, like it puts them into plantar flexion versus like sleeping in their boot. Or are you really strict about, no, you cannot take that thing off? Like, how do you manage the sleep part?
Yeah, well, that's a great point. So nobody knows what they're doing when they're sleeping. So, but with non-operative treatment, I ask the patient, I sort of ask them to ask themselves. It's like, are you a tosser and turner, or are you more like calm when you sleep?
Yeah.
And I said, only you know, or maybe the person you sleep with knows. And if you toss and turn a lot, then I probably would recommend you keep yourself in the boot. So in case you kick something, you're not like hyperdorsiflexing the ankle. And that's particularly the case if they had a surgery. I'm like overprotective of it if they had surgery. The night splint can work for that. And then I tell them to switch the wedges into the night splint so it still keeps them in plantar flexion. And typically people, tend to plantar flex their ankle when they sleep, because that's kind of the natural resting posture. And the Achilles is usually is the biggest, strongest tendon in the ankle, and so it overpowers like the dorsiflexor, So if they are relatively calm when they're sleeping, then I don't necessarily have them wear the boot with the wedges or the night splint with the wedges.
So for physical therapy, there is a lot in the literature comparing traditional rehab to accelerated, which you kind of hinted at, Bonnie. But rehab of non-surgically treated Achilles tears, it's also changed. I think we talk about like accelerated versus non, like you said, with surgery, but it's also changed over the years with the non-surgically treated. So can you give us kind of an overview on how that's changed, maybe even how that's changed since like you were in residency, you know, where we all were in residency together, and then fellowship, and now maybe what you're practicing? Have you become more aggressive at all, more conservative based on what you've seen? How has your approach to the rehab evolved?
Yeah, definitely. I'm in favor of it. And it, my protocol is actually pretty similar for surgery versus no surgery.
Okay.
It's just that if they have surgery, then I delay it by 2 weeks for the wound healing. And again, I don't really cast or splint them at all. They're in the boot. They're doing physical therapy basically right away. It's not totally non-weight bearing. It's touchdown. And then going from there, it's optimizing, keeping the ankle in plantar flexion and not overstretching it initially. So a lot of it is kind of strength at the beginning. And then after enough time, so about 6 to 8 weeks from the injury, then we work on the flexibility.
So that's in the same and then, since you started.
Something else that I think many of us have come across is like blood flow restriction as part of the rehab. I'm not an expert in it, but I think like Catherine with her physical therapy background and like speaking to physical therapists who know a lot more about it, I think there's some role in it. And certainly I encourage my patients if they go to a physical therapy place that offers it, that they make use of it. And I include it in my protocol. Like I actually have a protocol, like a table, like week by week with what I want the patients to work on, and I ask them to give it to the physical therapist. I ask them to keep a copy. I ask them to follow it strictly, not rush it, even if they feel great, because a tendon needs the time.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think it's exciting to see. Like, I love BFR. You know, we talk about it a lot on the show. It certainly has a lot of utility, like for ACL type stuff, but even like shoulder, there's a lot of data out with like rotator cuff and like working with pitchers and all this sort of stuff. And I'm excited to see it's finding its way in foot and ankle, because I think it's got a lot of great utility. And like you're saying, it, you know, you're trying to protect that repair. So you're, or I'm sorry, I should just say we're trying to protect that tendon, whether it's repair or non-repair. And, you know, it's just, we have to start to be creative. Like, how can we make sure that they're not atrophy excessively? So it's a nice option. So I'm glad to see that it's making its way into Achilles as well. I'm definitely not as knowledgeable with Achilles rehab, so it's very exciting. Yeah, so that's awesome.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Sports Docs. We hope you enjoyed the first part of our discussion as much as we did. On the next episode, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Chen and shift our focus to surgical treatment of Achilles tendon ruptures. Make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and now on YouTube to stay up to date on all things sports medicine. If you like what you hear, please consider leaving us a review or a comment. You can also reach us by email at thesportsdoctod@gmail.com or find us on Instagram at thesportsdocspod and Twitter at thesportsdocpod. We love your feedback.